I took the beginning meditation class the last few weeks, hoping to learn some things I never learned. And I suppose that's always a hope. And I recognize a couple of faces. Are there people here, are there people here who've been sitting longer than a year? Just give me a sense of my audience. Okay. I'd like to talk tonight about the first teaching of the Buddha, first discourse after his awakening. It's called the Dhammacakka Sutta. And he gave it to four fellow spiritual seekers who he had been spending time with over the past, who knows, lifetimes perhaps. And it's considered to be the central teaching of Buddhism. It's the central teaching, as far as I know, in all Buddhist traditions. And to me, the remarkable thing about one of the many remarkable things about this teaching is that it's written down in English in one page, the whole sutta. Now, I could just read that page to you, or I could just hand it to you to read for yourselves. But there's something between that page and our understanding that takes a lot longer, and I hope that I can facilitate that a little bit tonight. It's a very profound teaching, and yet it's very, very short. And the core of the teachings are the Four Noble Truths. But before the Buddha talks about the Four Noble Truths in this very short teaching, he brings up first two other points which are often not overlooked, but I think not emphasized enough. So I would like to start as he starts. The very first part of his discourse is that he talks to these fellow spiritual seekers who have been on a path which has had a lot of asceticism to it. He admonishes them about practicing self-torment, or these ascetic practices. And he also admonishes people in general for practicing a life of self-indulgence, of sensual indulgence. And instead he points toward a middle path, a path that is a path of moderation. And his idea in this middle path is that it's the path that leads to the least suffering, the least repercussions, the least sets in motion the least amount of rebounded thinking, as where indulgence tends to lead us toward more indulgence and asceticism tends to lead us toward perhaps self-hatred, self-inflicted discomfort, neither of which is the state that he's pointing toward, which is a state of peace and calm and non-attachment. So, and then he goes on to say, before he gets to the Four Noble Truths, he describes this middle path. And this middle path, he says, is precisely the Eightfold Path, which he enumerates at the beginning of this talk about the Four Noble Truths. And the Eightfold Path has three parts to it. The first two parts of the Eightfold Path are about wisdom. They are right view and right intention. Right view might be called right understanding. Right intention has to do with purpose, has to do with obviously setting one's goals and setting one's sights on. And at the outset of our practice, it's very hard to know what actually is contained in those two views. So he's pointing to those as at the very beginning, and yet there's a recognition here that this is a circular set of, this Eightfold Path has a circularity to it. It's starting out attempting to understand these things, working your way through the whole Eightfold Path, in a sense, reaching greater understanding, coming back with greater understanding, working your way through again. So it's not as if this is a practice where we sit down and first learn how to say the letter A and then the letter B and then we get to the end. It's much more a practice of making a little bit of understanding around and around this whole path, as the Four Noble Truths are, is what I will try to point out. The second part of the Eightfold Path are right speech, right action, right livelihood. And those are pointing toward a life of morality and also generosity, although generosity is not apparent in any of those. But if you think about it, right speech has not only the quality of doing no harm in it, it also has the quality of giving, of supporting, of putting aside your own needs for the needs of others, as do right action and right livelihood. They all point toward a life that is not putting oneself first, but a life of morality and generosity. The third part of this Eightfold Path is the last three of the eight are right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And those are pointing directly at meditation practice. And as we all have begun to understand, in the meditation practice, we start to develop a little bit more understanding of right view, of right understanding, of right intention. But he puts the meditation actually last in these eight and points instead toward the necessity of practicing a moral and generous life, which he puts ahead of the meditation practice. Now, most of us in the West certainly come to this practice through meditation. We perhaps come to it as a way of calming ourselves, of trying to get some, reduce the stress in our lives. And meditation is essential to that. But what tends to not get emphasized enough is that an awful lot of the stress in our lives is self-inflicted because of unskillful actions. Perhaps not right livelihood, perhaps not right speech or right action. So the torments of the mind may be coming from external causes, but they are largely coming from internal causes. Remorse, guilt, fear. And he's pointing then to laying these foundations where meditation is something that you essentially build on after having learned about these earlier parts of the Eightfold Path. And in Asia in general, teaching of the lay people is conducted in that order. And in the monastery, it's conducted in that order. The rules that are set down for you even to begin to have monastic life ensure that you're practicing all of these early parts of the Eightfold Path before you really get very far into meditation practice. So I just wanted to point out that that is actually in this one-page discourse, that is the first part, and then he goes on to the Four Noble Truths, which I would like to now go through. The First Noble Truth, the Four Noble Truths are laid out kind of like a prescription. We have a problem. There's a cause of the problem. There's a way to solve the problem. And the prescription for solving the problem is actually a way to live your life. So, in a way, you could look at it like a medical prescription about our minds. First noble truth, the truth of suffering, that life is suffering. Now, suffering is not a word that we perhaps have a lot of contact with. We generally have enough to eat. Most of us are physically healthy. Hopefully most of our loved ones are. So there are other words in an attempt to translate the word in Pali, which was dukkha, into English. There are other phrases that are used instead of suffering that you might find more immediate for yourselves. Stress, the oppressive nature of life, the unsatisfactoriness of life. And in each instance, you might find one or more of those more fitting. But these are all pointing toward a quality of being alive as human beings. And the Buddha is saying that these are inevitable aspects of being alive as human beings. Life is suffering. Not that life is entirely suffering. We all know about moments of joy. But suffering is an inevitable part of life. If you don't mind, I'll continue to use the word suffering because I'm habituated to it. But use your own word as I'm speaking if you like it more. I also want to differentiate between compulsory suffering. That's the suffering that we have, for example, with a broken bone, with the death of a loved one. There's an aspect of both of those that are, there's an unavoidable aspect of the suffering. And then there's what I would call optional suffering, which is what we add on top of that, unavoidable suffering, by our own mental activities, which are, I'm going to go forward with. But so what we're addressing here in the Four Noble Truths is this area of optional suffering, which probably amounts to the overwhelming amount of our suffering. Now, the phrase, life is suffering, also is not a personal phrase. There's nothing in it that suggests that it's just your life that's suffering, or my life. And to highlight this, I'd like to do a little group activity here. The first quality of suffering that the Buddha points to is the suffering that comes from not getting our desires. Would anyone here like to offer an example of the experience of not getting what you want?
Certainly, when one goes into a restaurant and orders a dish and they think that they know what it's going to consist of and then it doesn't, it can induce great suffering.
Is there anyone that has not had that experience? Yes.
And it was the a 6.0 quark, and of course I had the wrong disk, and I tried to call in, and they were closed, and I was livid. I was livid. It was my flesh crawled. I just suffered excruciating.
That's a pretty multicolored example you just given. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff in that one. Self-righteousness. I can hear it now, right? But we can all relate to that example. I'm sure it might not be a Quark 6.0, but something that we thought we had in our hands, and it turned out we didn't have it, and it wasn't doing what we wanted it to. The second area of suffering is being separated from our likes. Would anyone like to offer an example of that? Being separated from our likes. Yes. Any others? Oh, quitting smoking, yeah. Anyone here not had an experience of being separated from their likes? Ice cream, did you say? But this is an experience we can all relate to. Being separated from our likes. The third area he points to is being bound to our dislikes. Yes? A relationship we don't like? Clothes that don't fit? Anybody not had an experience of this kind? Okay, the last two categories are, I'll stop this class thing for the moment, but the last two point at areas of equal importance. They are the experiences of sorrow and lamentation. Grief, sadness, despair, fear, all of the negative afflictive emotions. And then the last category, birth, aging, sickness, and death. And he calls these five categories. I've just gone over the five aggregates. The last one in particular creates, I think, for most of us, a sense of ongoing dis-ease or disquiet. As clearly inevitable as we intellectually understand that we are going to die, there's a level of emotional acceptance that is extremely difficult to get to. And the point of this practice is to, I mean, I think all of us can intellectually understand these areas of suffering. All of us can understand that not only are there the areas of suffering, but we can intellectually understand the next noble truth, which is that the origin of suffering is our mental attachment to these things that are happening to us. Either our mental pushing away or our mental pulling toward us, our desire or our rejection. It's that mental activity which the Buddha calls craving, the craving of, the craving for sensual pleasures, craving for the cessation of certain things, or craving for the continuation of certain things. It's that craving that is at the root of our suffering. And there's an intellectual level at which we can understand that. But the point of this meditation practice is to really see over and over again all of the multitude of ways in our life that these different areas are present, both at the very gross level and the very subtle level, and all levels in between. I'll give you a very simple example of a subtle level. Yesterday, when I was sitting down to prepare this talk, I had this feeling when I sat down in the morning. I had a certain pressure. There was a lot of stuff I had to do, and I was I was aware of the fact that I was feeling sorry for myself because I had too much to do. A little bit later in the day, when I'd done what I needed to do, I had this feeling of nothing to do. They weren't running my life, but they were there. There was a definite sense of dis-ease, and as long as I have that feeling, as long as I'm caught in that feeling, I am not here in the present moment. I'm being carried along by this emotion that's mentally created attitude that's coloring my life at the moment. It's creating a certain sense of unpleasantness. So that's, you know, it's in this case, it's in both cases, it's wanting something, wanting to be basically separated from something that I'm bound to at that moment. Wanting to have it some other way. Or it's a, or you could say it's a craving for cessation. I would like to have this, I would like this feeling of being too busy to stop. I would like this feeling of not having enough to do stop. I would like this feeling of getting older to stop. I mean, whatever this discomfort is that's going on, that I want that to stop. That is the actual source of the suffering. As soon as you can stop wanting it, that suffering stops. And that's the third noble truth, that the cessation of suffering is the cessation of the craving. Very simple, in principle. Now, how do we achieve, in the third noble truth, the cessation of craving? This is where the practice comes in. In order to achieve a cessation of craving, to be released from this suffering, first of all, we have to be aware that we are having this craving. We have to be able to be aware of what it is that we want and that we are actually wanting it, and then we have to be able to let go of that wanting. And how do we do that? How do we let go of the wanting? If we let go of it in a way of saying, all right, I'm not going to get that, I just don't want it, that kind of pushing away, I think we know in a fairly clear way, that will not stay away. That will be back very quickly. It sets up such a reverberation in our emotional, mental life that you don't get to a point of not craving by basically rejecting. You have to get there in some kind of way of letting go, of releasing, of doing it in a very... in a way that's without passion, that's just letting out your breath. And in the sitting practice, when you can identify what this craving is, and you can be mindful of it and put your mindfulness on that craving, however it manifests itself in your body and mind, it may manifest itself in terms of mental anguish. It may manifest itself also in physical anguish or physical sensation of some kind. And if you can stay there with those experiences in your own body and simply watch them, they will fade away. They will fade away because there is this quality of impermanence and it rules all. And you can actually just watch it fade away. Now, if you insist on giving rebirth to it by putting more energy into it, then it will be reborn again. But if you are just simply mindful, accepting, noticing what's going on, you know, what is this sense of craving that's happening without fueling it with, yeah, but I want that, or whatever way that you would refuel it, or I don't want that, or I have perfectly good reasons not to want that. But if you can simply watch that sense of craving, it will go away, and you will no longer be suffering in that moment. That particular aspect of suffering will have gone. Not to say it won't come back. There's nothing here about never coming back. It's about in that moment of mindfulness. It might only be just a moment. You're actually going to, if you pay attention to what's happening, as you watch the craving dissolve away, you will see the suffering is gone. There's nothing there anymore with it. And in that, just in that moment, these Four Noble Truths have been demonstrated. In the next moment, who knows? If it's not a moment of mindfulness, some other craving will perhaps be born. Something else that we want or don't want or want to be separated from. So, how do we extend this? How do we get from just these momentary moments of calm and peace to something more enduring? We do it with this practice. This is the practice over and over and over, and we very slowly condition ourselves to realize what this little mechanism is, how this works, how to release ourselves, and as we get more and more habituated to doing that, and parenthetically, this is really what retreats are all about. It's the opportunity to do this hour after hour after hour and actually get the accumulated experience of it. And then you start to see that these little moments get longer. And they get long enough that you can begin to think, you know, this might actually extend out to the point where my life is more in this place than it is in this place of suffering and craving. So it's about habituating our minds to being mindful, to letting go, and thereby releasing ourselves from suffering, which we do with this practice. And I might say one of the wonderful things about this practice is, even if you don't have any ambitions for releasing yourself from all of this suffering, even if you're just here because your life is too stressful and you want some relief from it, it's the same practice. It doesn't matter how lofty your ambitions are for yourself. It's exactly the same practice. It's going to take you to a little bit less stress in your life, and then a little bit less, and then a little bit less, and then a little bit less. And depending on how dedicated and determined you are, you just continue on down that road. But it's just, there's no change in technique. There's nothing you have to do differently. Kindergarten is exactly like 12th grade. Just keep on doing it. But your understanding increases, of course. And It's all about your own understanding. It's all about acquiring this knowledge at the most deep intuitive level, not simply hearing it from somebody or reading it in the sutta. It's about really getting it. And it seems like that's what it takes. There are occasional these heroic stories about how the Buddhist gives this talk and somebody's instantly enlightened, at least in these heroic stories. And these are wonderful inspirations to us, but they can also be wonderful frustrations to us, because that's not the way it's happening for us. It's taking a lot more work than that, and we're not even who knows how far away we are from it. So I don't know why those heroic stories are given, really, other than to perhaps to point to the special quality of teaching, perhaps, that the Buddha had, or the high level of preparation that the student already had before the Buddha spoke to him or her. I'm not clear about that. It's not anything that I personally can relate to. So I'd like to stop there. Are there any questions? Yes.
So can you talk about the suffering that happens as a result of us craving things, wanting things that are hard or something? What's the difference between that and having a goal for yourself that you need to follow?
I'm sorry.
Having a goal. So if someone has a job they don't like, or that relationship isn't quite right or something like that, there's probably different ways you go about doing things, but it seems like there's some action sometimes needed, and you have something in mind that you're moving towards.
I think, I guess this idea is open to the suggestion that perhaps what this means is we should kind of give up on life. I don't myself hear it that way at all. This word craving is craving is a word that I think most of us can feel viscerally. It's like I need for this unpleasant job to change now. I need for it. The fact that it's unpleasant makes it, I mean, what's wrong with these people that I'm working with? I mean, why do they make it so unpleasant? This is such a lousy place I'm working. On and on, the stories, we can build up these stories. We can also say, this job doesn't suit me. I'm going to begin to think about ways that I might change that. I can begin to consider whether perhaps within this job there are things I could do that might, by changing my relationship with the people around me, by asking for a new assignment, by whatever I might do. And if that's not, doesn't bear any fruit, perhaps I begin to then look for another possibility elsewhere. So you can go about things, setting intentions and going about them in a skillful way without bringing on this sense of craving, of the impatience, of the angst around it, which is where the suffering is, a lot of the suffering. Not all of it, because it is an example this fellow gave, an unpleasant job. How much of it's unpleasant because the job itself is inherently unpleasant, and how much it's unpleasant because of what he's putting on top of it, only he can judge. We have a few minutes, and I'd like to, I think in general we have another meditation period, and I would like to offer something a little bit different tonight. Perhaps some other, it has been offered before. And I need to say something about this, in addition to mindfulness practice in the Buddhist tradition, there are a set of practices called the Brahma Viharas, which are the divine abodes in English, and they are the practices of loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy and equanimity. And in those practices, they are not a mindfulness practice. They are a concentration practice where you deliberately set about to cultivate in your own mind a habit or a predisposition toward these positive emotions. So in this practice, which I'm going to lead us with for a few minutes, we actually say phrases. And the phrases we say are phrases that we can pick individually, but I'll offer some suggestions. And these phrases are going to sound perhaps trite, perhaps simplistic. So you need to work with them yourself to come to some phrases that you feel comfortable with. But I can tell you from personal experience that practicing these phrases actually can change, it has changed my habits of mind. And when I'm getting angry about something that's happened, I found that this habit of mind is more accessible now than it used to be. And actually, when I start feeling myself start to get angry, I immediately can flip over into, let's suppose somebody cut me off on the street, I can flip over into a compassion practice that says, I'm sorry that you're in such a hurry that your life is not happy, that it's stressful. And it immediately takes that separating feeling of anger that comes about when somebody, that's a form of road rage, and creates instead a connecting emotion, which is, I'm sorry that your life is so stressful that you needed to cut me off. I mean, it immediately changes things. It immediately changes the whole landscape of my own mind. And these practices are valued for that reason, that they can be used on a personal way, however one chooses to do it, 5 minutes a day, whatever works, to incline one's own mind toward more positive emotional relationships with the world around them. So tonight, rather than having a mindfulness sitting, I would like to go through an example. And the form of this, of these, whether it's loving kindness or compassion or sympathetic joy or equanimity, is that you start with yourself. You start by wishing yourself loving kindness or compassion or joy or equanimity, and then you go to a loved one and repeat the wishes. A loved one, someone close, someone that's very easy to do that with outside of yourself. And then you go to a neutral person, and in each case you have this person in mind, yourself and then the loved one and then the neutral person. And then finally, a negative person, a person with whom you don't have very a positive relationship, and you practice extending loving joy and compassion to them. And if you find it too hard to do either the neutral person or the difficult person, come back to the beginning, come back to yourself and start again. But eventually you'll find that you can actually begin to hold this person that you're having a hard time in your life with in your mental picture and genuinely wish them loving kindness, compassion, whatever. And my experience is you find it actually changes the relationship, even though they've done nothing. You change the landscape of your own mind. So I'd like to So I will, this is a guided meditation. I will lead this. I will be saying some things, and if you don't like my words, put your own words in. So sitting comfortably again with your eyes closed. Bring your attention to yourself. And tonight I'll do the first of the Brahmaviharas, which is loving kindness, which is also called metta in Pali. So the phrases that I have found that suit myself, I'll offer to you, but please find your own. May I be safe from all harm. May I be well and strong. May I be happy and at peace. And care for myself with joy. May I be safe from all of harm. May I be well and strong. May I be happy and at peace and care for myself with joy. And if you'd continue on by yourself for a few moments. Now bringing into mind a loved one or a benefactor. And directing loving kindness toward that person. May you be safe from all of harm. May you be well and strong. May you be happy and at peace and care for yourself with joy. May you be safe from all of harm. May you be well and strong. May you be happy and at peace and care for yourself with joy. And then continuing on by yourself. Now bring to mind a neutral person, a person that's neither a loved one or a difficult one. Doesn't have to even be someone that you know the name of. Now wishing that neutral person loving kindness. May you be safe from all harm. May you be well and strong. May you be happy and at peace and care for yourself with joy. May you be safe from all of harm. May you be well and strong. May you be happy and at peace and care for yourself with joy. Now continuing with metta for the neutral person by yourself. Now, if you can, bring up for yourself a difficult person and send wishes of loving kindness to that difficult person. If you find in doing it that it's too difficult, then go back to the neutral person or to a loved one or to yourself. Be safe from all of harm. May you be well and strong. May you be happy and at peace and care for yourself with joy. May you be safe from all of harm. May you be well and strong. May you be happy and at peace and care for yourself with joy. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for your practice.